It is my very good pleasure to welcome you, each one, to this morning's lecture, which is the third in the Carver Barnes Memorial Foundation series for 1969. The series theme this year is Particular Baptist Foundations, 1638 to 1660, and this third lecture is entitled Mission Methods. Our most able and eloquent lecturer for this 1969 series is the Reverend Dr. Barrington White, who is known to his friends as Barry and to certain students and other Baptists of Southern England as, well, on second thought, never mind. We've already been edified by his scholarship and delighted by his wit, and reference has been made in previous mornings to his academic preparation, his pastoral and teaching ministry. We have further been blessed by the rare opportunity to hear English spoken, and not only by an Englishman, but by an Englishman who is at once a graduate of both Oxford and Cambridge. And this indeed is an opportunity which brings with it a variety of accompaniment benefits, not to mention insights. One student, for example, told me yesterday that the lecture had progressed well past its midpoint before he realized that controversy was not just another early Baptist founding father with a psychedelic name. Upon reflection, I think this was an insight of considerable magnitude, and I hope Dr. White and Dr. Patterson will provide us with documentation for it. As delighted as we are to have Dr. White, we are at least equally delighted to have his charming wife, Margaret, as well. Now, some of you have not had the privilege of meeting her, and I'm going to embarrass her now by asking her to stand so that everybody can see what she looks like. Please, would you? Thank you very much, Margaret. You can see that there is beauty in the family as well as intelligence. We hope that this will be but the first of many visits by the Barry Whites to Wake Forest. It is a privilege, Barry, to invite you now to tell us in particular about Particular Baptist Mission Methods.
Dr. Durham and members of the faculty and the student body and friends, I have no doubt that my lady was reminded, as Dr. Durham spoke, as I was, of a remark made by a very famous English general. We have had famous English generals, many of them, but this was the greatest, greater perhaps even than George Washington. This was the Duke of Wellington, who Arthur Wellesley, first Duke of Wellington and scourge of Napoleon, had that characteristic of some Englishmen which led him to believe that he was at least as good as anybody else on earth and better than most. And on one occasion during his later years, the victor of Waterloo was walking down the Mall in London and encountered a gentleman who rushed up to him, shook him warmly by the hand, and said, "Mr. Jones, I believe." And the Duke of Wellington replied, "Sir, if you will believe that, you will believe anything." I will not take it upon myself to link that remark with Dr. Durham's, but I think you can see the direction of our joint white mind this morning. Well now, on mission methods. The mission methods of a small group working out from London, the spokes almost of a wheel with their missions throughout England, Scotland, Wales and Ireland during the 1640s and 50s. A mission group not cluttered with enormous churches which they could not fill and could not pay to keep up, as the Baptists so often in England today are, a small group who were Calvinists and yet were not paralyzed by their Calvinism, but took seriously that great word of Paul's, which is the watchword of Calvinism at its best: if God be for us, who can be against us? Now, the Confession of 1644, of which I've spoken to you before, afforded not only the first evidence of seven London congregations of Calvinistic Baptists, closed membership churches, acting in concert, it also outlined the convictions and foreshadowed the policy upon which their later missions were to be based. Article 33 in 1644 restricted membership of the church to those who had been baptized as believers, and Article 45 affirmed that any church member to whom God hath given gifts, being tried, that is tested in the church, may and ought by the appointment of the congregation to teach publicly the word of God. Notice, by the appointment of the congregation. Soon after a new edition of the Confession had been published in 1646, one of its signatories, a converted clergyman, Benjamin Cox, published an appendix to a confession of faith to emphasize and expand some of the teaching that was given in it. He wrote, he explained, to answer the inquiry of some well-affected and godly persons in the country. The whole tone of the pamphlet, where the characteristic personal pronoun was not I, but we, suggests that Cox felt himself to be supplying not so much a personal gloss on the confession, but a further exposition in greater detail of the joint mind of those who signed it. Two of his sections deal explicitly with the subject of this lecture. The first dealt with the qualifications and powers of itinerant Baptist evangelists. He wrote, "A disciple gifted and enabled by the Spirit of Christ to preach the gospel is a man authorized and sent by Christ. And they which are converted from unbelief and false worship," and you must remember that it was not, the Baptist mission was not merely that of cutting down stragglers from other denominations. It was that of preaching Christ, first and last. "They which are converted from unbelief and false worship, and so brought into church fellowship by such preachers, are a seal of their ministry." Brought into church fellowship. This is also one of the key points in their program. You didn't baptize and then leave them. You baptized them and drew them into fellowship, into the visible congregation of Christ's people in that place. "And such preachers of the gospel may not only lawfully administer baptism unto believers and guide the action of a church in the use of the supper, but may also call upon the churches and advise them to choose fit men for offices, and may settle such offices, so chosen by a church, in the places or offices to which they are chosen by imposition of hands and prayer." Now, although I've omitted the biblical references which Cox supplied, most of them from the book of the Acts, it'll be clear to all of you that it is the New Testament, and in particular the Acts of the Apostles, seen through the eyes, the spectacles of a left-wing English Puritan in the 17th century. This is the basis of his teaching, and all that he's just said that I've read out to you can be derived from the Acts of the Apostles. The second section, which bears upon the mission methods and strategy of these early Calvinistic Baptists, was shorter and made their closed communion position more explicit. "We do not," wrote Benjamin Cox, who was an Oxford man, "we do not admit any to the use of the supper, nor communicate with any in the use of this ordinance, but disciples baptized, lest we should have fellowship with them in their doing contrary to order." That was the basis, the order of the gospel. Even before Benjamin Cox wrote, the policy which his pamphlet had envisaged was well launched, was bearing fruit, although, oddly enough, almost the only evidence which exists for its first phase is preserved in the book written in three parts, published in 1646, and entitled Gangrena, or a catalogue and discovery of many of the errors, heresies, blasphemies, and pernicious practices of the sectaries of this time. It is not, as you might believe, a summary of Baptist principles. Its author was a fiery Presbyterian named Thomas Edwards. In his preface to the members of the Long Parliament, Edwards informed them that the sects have been growing upon us ever since the first year of your sitting and have every year increased more and more. Things have been bad a great while, but this last year they are grown intolerable. Although he criticized all the sects, he realized that distinctions could and should be made between the various groups. I put a wide difference, he wrote, between a simple, pure, independent, yea, a simple Anabaptist, who only holds that opinion denying pedo-baptism, and between an Arian, anti-Trinitarian, anti-scripturist, perfectist. Indeed, he would probably not have classed the independents with the others at all, had they not demanded toleration as much for the other sectaries as themselves. In the composition of the three parts of his book Gangrena, and Thomas Edwards is known by the unlovely name in English church history of Gangrena Edwards, he used many sources, the pamphlets written by his opponents themselves, reminiscences of his own encounters with the sectaries, and particularly letters written to him and documents secured for him by many sympathizers throughout the country. Naturally, he tended to put the worst construction on whatever he heard about the sectaries. This is a well-known principle of church history, as everybody who's ever read anything about other people's heresies well knows. He tended to put the worst construction on whatever he heard about the sectaries, but there is no doubt that his sources are normally clearly indicated and that he usually had some sort of factual basis for much of what he said by way of criticism or complaint. Lots of people are very rude, you see, about Thomas Edwards, especially the descendants, like ourselves, of the people that he was rude about. But there is no doubt that he did take some care to base his rudeness upon facts, which, after all, is better than some. However, the especially interesting fact about the material assembled in the Gangrena for our present purposes is the clear evidence that the Baptists, or as he called them, the Anabaptists, were highly active and aggressive in propagating their views. He talks about many different sects, but if you read right through it and you assemble all he says about the Baptists, it is quite clear that this is the group who are really going places, and this is the group who therefore upset him most. While Edwards himself makes no distinction between Arminian and Calvinistic Baptists, it's normally fairly easy for us to distinguish between them because, of course, we know the names of the leaders belonging to both wings of the Baptist movement. One popular method used by the Baptists for spreading their convictions was that of the public disputation, such as the one I mentioned in my first lecture between Dr. Featley and William Kiffin with his friends in Southwark. One method of managing such an occasion, which Thomas Edwards described, leaves me torn between appreciation of the ingenuity of our Baptist forefathers and discomfort at their apparent lack of scruple. And I record this merely in the interests of history and not as a recommendation to you in organizing revivals. Here is how Edwards described their goings-on, without any hint of whether the miscreants were generals or particulars. They have appointed and kept disputations from town to town in the country, giving out the time, places, and questions they will dispute of, as of pedo-baptism or the ministry of the Church of England. And they agree among themselves that some of them, you can imagine these little evangelistic teams, you see, going along the curling, muddy roads of old England, they agree among themselves that some of them shall seem to be for pedo-baptism, And in the disputation, 'tis maintained at first eagerly by some of their party that infants should be baptized, against others of them who oppose it. But then, after long and great disputation, at last they confess that they are by the evidence of truth convinced, and before all the people give glory to God that now they see the truth, whereby the people, seeing them who pleaded for pedo-baptism confessing their error and yielding, they knowing nothing of this pre-contract and deceit, they also stumble, question, and fall. And I think we can understand how effective such a method could be without really approving of it. The narrative seems too circumstantial to be easily dismissed as a lie. One can only hope that this method was not widely used. By the spring of 1646, the civil war in England was virtually over. But a few royalist strongholds continued to hold out, and the last of them, Harlech in Wales, traditionally a backward part of the country, did not surrender until March 1647. However, the parliamentary army and its garrisons across the country were to play a significant part not only in national politics, but in the Baptist story for a number of years to come. You have to remember that the army goes on even though the Civil War is over. And although it has long been realized that Baptists in the army spread their convictions from garrison to garrison, it has not previously been noticed that Edwards provides some detail concerning the methods by which they spread their views in a new town. When Baptist soldiers were quartered in some large town, he alleged, they have desired the use of several houses of persons well affected, that in the afternoon some Christians might meet to confer together of some points. Not contenting themselves to reason in the house where quartered, or in any one house that might be larger to hold many, but to get a new house every day, the more to infect and possess the people with their ways and tenets. With this sort of thing happening all over the country, and with doctrines they would consider far more dangerous than the Baptist denial of the validity of infant baptism, it is perhaps not surprising that Edwards and his friends regarded a policy of general toleration as the grand design of the devil, his masterpiece and chief engine he works by to uphold his tottering kingdom. It is the most compendious, ready, sure way to destroy all religion, lay all waste, and bring in all evil. Now that's an English Presbyterian speaking. Anybody who's read anything about early history of Baptists in New England knows how seriously they took a very similar view of toleration in the 17th century in New England. Well, while it's not possible to follow up all Gangrena Edwards' references to individual particular Baptists in 1646, and I imagine you may be relieved about that, I intend to examine in detail the material he provides concerning one Thomas Collier, who during the late 1640s and 1650s was the Baptist chief apostle in the west of England, and whose ministry was a notable early embodiment of the policy outlined by Benjamin Cox in the passage which I read to you earlier. Edwards' earliest reference described him as one Collier, a great sectary in the west of England, a mechanical fellow, and a great emissary, a dipper, who goes about Surrey, Hampshire, and those counties thereabouts, these are the southern counties of England, preaching and dipping. A fortnight before Edwards wrote, Collier had been, he said, in Guildford, a county town not far from London, speaking to the congregation gathered by an independent who had himself drawn away his people from those godly ministers whom before they had much prized. A godly minister to Thomas Edwards, of course, is a Presbyterian minister, and an ungodly minister is one of the others. This mutual tolerance between some independents and some Baptists had already been noted by Edwards without approval. This is the movement which goes on through the Civil War period. You go from Anglican to Presbyterian to Congregationalist to Baptist, and sometimes further out still to the Seekers and the Quakers and the others. There's this steady movement of men. And some people who can be labeled in your Baptist bibliographies in the 1650s as Baptists, by the end of the 1650s have moved on to Quakerism. Of course, the best have not. Certainly Collier ranged widely in the course of his missionary labors. He'd even visited Guernsey and the Channel Islands between England and France, and had been driven out because of his opinions and turbulency, and then had, according to Edwards's own unwilling testimony, done much hurt in the south of England. It appears that Edwards himself had even had a personal encounter with Collier, during which they had discussed the morality of the Sabbath and baptism. The conference, which had lasted some 5 hours, evidently ended, as so many of them do, inconclusively, with Edwards convinced that such was quite sufficient time for one to trouble himself with such a vain, unruly talker. And there's not a professor, I imagine, at Southeastern Seminary who has not met one of those. Vain, unruly talker or not, it appears that Thomas Collier was an effective evangelist for his cause. According to a letter from a worthy minister in the west of England, when he was driven out of the Channel Islands, Collier was accompanied by many more of his followers whom he had seduced. Afterwards, presumably immediately upon his return to the mainland, he spent some time in prison at Portsmouth. The writer reported that he'd heard that the Baptist leader was an illiterate carter or an husbandman. And this is characteristic of some of the Baptist evangelists of this first period. They are men who learn to read and learn to preach, but not in school or college. But he nevertheless asserted that he was the first that sowed the seeds of Anabaptism among the rest in these parts. He is the man who goes out from London through the south and west of England. It's an odd fact that he was alleged to be tainted with Arminianism, but I haven't seen any clear evidence to justify this. When one John Sims, a shoemaker of Southampton in the south of England, was arrested in Bridgewater in the west of England, in Somerset, for preaching in a parish church without permission, a packet of letters written by Thomas Collier and others was found upon him. And you can imagine how valuable this is to the historian, and the only record and evidence we have of them is Edwards' reprint of them in Gangrena. The letters eventually came into Edwards' hands, and he published 4 or 5, apparently verbatim, and they were concerned with the difficulties and encouraging the Baptists of this period. The letters were particularly concerned, in one case, with a letter written from Taunton in Somerset, in the west of England, by one William Haywood, to commend a man called Reeves as a member in the Order and Fellowship of the Gospel with the Saints in Taunton. He, the letter explained, would be able to give fuller details of the difficulties the Baptists there were experiencing at the hands of the governor, presumably of the parliamentary garrison in Taunton Castle. He maintained that their meeting stemmed not from tenderness of conscience, but rather from damnable pride. And I imagine this is a difficulty which people dealing with Baptists have always had, to know which it was. What is particularly interesting is that in one of the other letters, Thomas Collier tells us that there were 14 converts at Poole in Dorset, and he organized these into a church. Now, in England at the present time, we hardly think that 14 converts were a viable unit. I don't know what your feelings would be, but they were quite happy about it. With these letters, the references to Thomas Collier in Gangrena conclude, but it's clear that already by the spring of 1646, his area of operation stretched at least as far as from Guildford in Surrey near London to Taunton in Somerset, deep in the west of England. Yet it would be wrong to assume, even at this early date, that he and his immediate circle were the only Calvinistic Baptists active in the West Country. In fact, a letter dated the 3rd of June in the same year, 1646, reported that further west still, in Devon and Cornwall, Paul Hobson, who had been one of those who had signed the 1644 confession, had been sent as an emissary to Exeter to raise a party there. A few days later, another letter, this time addressed to Hobson himself at the house of a friend in Exeter, came from Dartmouth, even further west. So what you have is having the near west, as we might say, evangelized by Thomas Collier, and the far west being evangelized by Paul Hobson and his friends. To turn from the West Country in 1646 to Wales in the years after 1649 is to turn to rather a different mission with rather different leadership, but nonetheless this too was sponsored and advised by the same London churches who were in touch with Thomas Collier's work. This, the earliest known mission initiated and superintended in detail from London, of which detailed information survives, was connected with the dispatch of John Miles, 1621 to 1683, to South Wales in 1649. After the restoration of Charles II in 1660, Miles and his congregation from Swansea in South Wales came to New England and brought their church book with them. And so the church book is here in New England, I think in Brown University, and persons like myself can only in fact have photostats in England to read the story from. But the story is largely recorded in their church book and in the letters which they copied into it. In contrast with the mission to the south and west of England, Miles and at least three others who came to be closely associated with his work were all formerly ministers of the Church of England and all received state support at this period under the provisions of an Act for the Better Propagation and Preaching of the Gospel in Wales. This is worth remembering because Baptists often say that we've always consistently been against it. And we haven't been consistent, though probably from the 18th century onwards we have been. But they did accept state support for the propagation of the gospel in Wales, a very needy part of the land. It was probably in the late autumn, in the late summer or early autumn of 1649 that John Miles and his friend Thomas Proud, ministers of the Church of England, who had recently come to Baptist convictions, arrived in London from Glamorgan. There they encountered the particular Baptist church which met in Glaziers Hall. That was the city guild, the worshipful guild of glass makers, the glaziers, whose hall was rented out to this Baptist congregation in Broad Street, London. Soon after, that congregation had prayed for evangelists to preach in those places where the Lord had work to be done. It seems probable the two men were baptized in London, and then, as the Ilston Swansea Church book later reported, they were again recommended into these parts. They were sent forth as evangelists. They seem to have returned to Glamorgan in South Wales about the middle of September 1649, and within a fortnight, two women were baptized, and soon afterwards, four more women. That the first new members of their church were women may have been a little disappointing to the two evangelists, who afterwards explained that the Lord was teaching them by this not to despise the day of small things. Nevertheless, from then onwards, their work so prospered that their congregation soon grew to a considerable number. Miles now decided to preach his Baptist convictions in a new area. And this is the other thing which is so characteristic of these period. These men were restless. Paul's restlessness seems to have been exacerbated, if that's the right word. No doubt Dr. Durham will explain it to me and to you afterwards, if necessary. Paul's restlessness seems to have been exacerbated by the fact that he normally began his campaigns in a synagogue and was thrown out. But with these Baptists of this period, they seem to be quite content that as soon as there are a few converts, they move on and on and on. I don't think this is characteristic of Baptist missionary work in other parts of the world in later days. We tend to settle down as soon as we've got a group and try and hold them together. Anyway, this is what he did. And he travelled north into the centre of Wales to the county of Breconshire. There he was permitted to argue the case for believers' baptism in a group, in a congregation of independents, of congregationalists, people with the same church doctrine but without believers' baptism. This probably happened in January 1650, and the turn events soon took effectively illustrates the attitude of Miles and his particular Baptist friends, even to independents, those who were closest to them. It seems that by the time John Miles left this group, To return to Ilston, the two elders of that congregation, Walter Prosser and James Hughes, accepted the teaching about believers' baptism and promised to write reporting what their church finally decided to do about believers' baptism. When the letter came, its contents were disappointing. Jenkin Jones, a much-respected independent leader, had both written to them and then visited them in order to dissuade them from accepting believers' baptism from John Miles. Finally, the letter said, he desired us to make no haste, nor to be rash in the using of it, without the advice of those who were in Christ before us, Mr. Vavasor Powell and Mr. Craddock, two leading independent or congregationalists in Wales. And he desired us to write to them and to their congregations to know their advice about baptism. Jenkin Jones then asked that nothing should be done until he visited the congregationalists in 5 weeks' time to administer the Lord's Supper. The situation was that among the congregationalists in this little group, there were 10 or a dozen people who were convinced for believers' baptism, while the rest were less opposed than undecided. In view of all this, Walter Prosser and James Hughes suggested that John Miles should not return until after they had been visited by the congregationalist leader, lest there should be any rent or division among the company, and that those who favored believers' baptism would appear to have caused a breaking up of this church. Now, the first reaction at Ilston when this letter was read to John Miles and his church there in South Wales was to agree that this was not the right time to encourage him to revisit the Congregationalists. But after prayer, they changed their mind and sent a further mission, including Miles, with a letter in reply to Prosser and Hughes. In this, they first argued that those who favored believers' baptism would hardly be guilty of a formal breach of communion or schism, because, you see, they maintained that this church was not a proper church anyway, because it was not gathered on the basis of believers' baptism. So the Baptists need have no worry about separating from a congregation of what they called scattered saints, which wasn't really properly a congregation at all. And secondly, the letter which went with John Miles argued, although they honored those godly men, Vavasor Powell and Walter Craddock, it would be far better for the people at Llanigan, the Congregationalists, to consult the Scriptures, that infallible word of truth, than those who were already known to oppose believers' baptism. The consequence of this letter and of John Miles' second visit was a considerable number there baptized and joined together in the order of the gospel. This dispute shows, not for the first time, nor for the last, an independent congregation, in its own view, properly, scripturally constituted on the basis of a covenant, turning over virtually in a body to become a Baptist congregation. And this resulted in a second congregation of Calvinistic Baptists being founded by John Miles. The next advance was the acceptance by a parish minister of believers' baptism. And he was sent out to preach believers' baptism in his district, and many of his parish congregation were won over. Meanwhile, opposition to the Baptist activities in South Wales was building up, and they were finding that they were very unpopular, and news had gone home to London that John Miles, who was accepting state pay, was preaching sectarian doctrine. And so they had difficulty in bringing it together. But they had two more congregations soon growing up and soon united together in fellowship as Calvinistic Baptists in South Wales. And it is this group which is one of the earliest groups to come together in what we would now recognize to be an association. But about associations I'll be speaking tomorrow. But this section of the early particular Baptist story can't be told merely in terms of the leadership and the restless evangelism of men like John Miles and Thomas Proud and the others. Always in the background there was the watchful care of the church meeting in Glaziers Hall in London. And behind them, at least after the summer of 1653, There stood the wider fellowship of both associations and individual congregations sharing Baptist convictions in England, Scotland, and Ireland. Letters were transcribed from the London Church into the Ilston Church Book, which demonstrate that a correspondence was carried on not only with Ilston, but with the other three out of the four other churches in this little group in South Wales. It seems also that Miles himself visited the London leaders at least once more, since a letter of 1652 mentioned the several epistles which we have received from you by our brother Miles. In the letters from London, in addition to general exhortations to holiness of life, great emphasis was laid upon the danger of any compromise over the closed communion question. The last example of a mission sponsored from London with which I intend to deal in this lecture is one which seems to have come to grief, in part, over this very issue of closed communion. This mission was undertaken by Thomas Tillam in Northumberland, right in the north of England. Tillam described himself as minister and a messenger of one of the seven churches in London. That is, from that close-knit group of congregations which had cooperated in the 1644 confession and in some later publications. And he arrived in Hexham, Northumberland, on the 27th of December, 1651. He had been commissioned by the church led by Hansard Knowles, spelt Knollys. There's a book about Hansard Knowles published by the Broadman Press in their historical monographs series by Professor Pope Duncan. And Tillam was sent out by them as their missionary. Later on, they recalled this in a letter which they wrote. "We gave him," they said, of Tillam, "our letter of recommendation and sent him forth to preach the gospel and to baptize them that did believe the same. And accordingly, as the Lord did assist and direct him, to be instrumental to set them in an orderly way wherein they might worship God in spirit and in truth." In addition to this, Tillam had secured appointment under the commissioners set up by the Long Parliament to inquire into the state of religion in the northern counties of England, and he had secured appointment to a lectureship established in Hexham some years before by members of one of the great guild companies in London who are Puritans, the Mercers' Company. So here is another man, you see, supported in his evangelistic campaign by other money than Baptist money and by some state support. But as far as we know, this man had never been a minister. Tillam's ministry was at first as fruitful as that of John Miles in South Wales. Only 7 months after his arrival, 11 men and 5 women were baptized on the 21st of July, 1652, as founder members of the particular Baptist church at Hexham, solemnly giving up themselves to the Lord and one to another to walk in communion together with submission to all the ordinances of the gospel. Between July and December 1652, 12 more men and 6 more women were baptized and added to the church. Then on the 20th of December, 1652, the church, with prayer, fasting, and imposition of hands of the minister, ordained Brother Hickhorn Gill, a minister, and their messenger into Scotland, and Brother John Thirlwall, a deacon. Now you see, you have a new church which has now produced its own evangelist, and he goes out to Scotland, further north still. The trouble is that he also gets into a great deal of difficulties, and he ends up at the end of a very long life, actually, in the early 18th century as a Church of England vicar of very liberal views. And he appears as Hickering Gill in the English Dictionary of National Biography, which I see you have in your college seminary library. But this is part of the uncertainty of the years. And this is something that we should be very much aware of in this period, that men are passing through the Baptist position as well as lodging in it. On the 3rd of April 1653, the church solemnly commended their minister to the grace of God for the work in Cheshire and sent their deacon with him in much love. Now this again is Tillam being sent out from the church he's founded at Hexham. And he's sent into Cheshire, which is another one of the northern counties in England. A highly successful preaching tour which followed and lasted apparently for not more than three or four weeks was the means by which many were added to the church in Cheshire. And so we know there was a congregation there already. After the addition in May of three more men and six more women to the membership at Hexham, a rather extraordinary episode took place. The case of the false Jew. You will be aware also that in the 1650s, England opened her frontiers to the Jews once more, and it was also believed by many Puritans who were much wound up about the last things and expected the return of the Lord Jesus very soon, that the conversion of the Jews was part of our English mission at that time. And so there was great interest in the Jews, and there was great pressure on the government to agree to allow them back into the country. Tillam had proudly proclaimed the conversion of a Jew, Joseph ben Israel, to the Christian faith, had baptized him on his most glorious profession of Christ. Unfortunately, the convert turned out to be a Scottish Roman Catholic named Thomas Ramsay, who had been sent to the north to create trouble among the various Puritan groups there. Now, how they mistook a man from Israel for a Scot, or a Scot for a man from Israel, I don't myself understand. But there's no doubt that Tillam was thoroughly taken in. The Newcastle Independent and Presbyterian preachers, just a few miles away from Hexham, got hold of the truth of the matter and were delighted to use it to embarrass the Baptists. They asked Ramsay to come to Newcastle, some 12 miles down the River Tyne from Hexham, to clear his name from the doubts which had been expressed concerning his story. He came with Tillam and several other Hexham Baptists, only to be confronted with the master of the ship which had brought him over from Hamburg to the port nearby in August 1652 under the name of Horsley. Soon the whole shabby truth was out, and he was sent up to London under arrest. What happened to him afterwards is quite unknown. The affair is important for two reasons. First, it serves as a reminder to us of the importance of the widespread Puritan interest in the Jews and their conversion as a sign of the last times during the 1650s. Secondly, it enabled the mainstream Newcastle Puritans to strike a telling blow against the Baptists, who were made to look foolish in the district. And as you all know, the popular image of a church or of a sect does make some difference to the effectiveness of its evangelism. Thomas Tillam, nevertheless, was responsible for two more Baptist successes in the north. In July, he won over the Puritan parish minister of Stokesley in Yorkshire, a county also in the north, William Kay, and 19 of his people to believers' baptism. Less than 3 weeks later, he had another success, which cannot have endeared him to the Puritan ministers of the district. The story is briefly told in his own words. Three ministers were preaching in Muggleswick, a village a few miles southeast of Hexham, Tillam's headquarters. Their great design being to set up infant sprinkling, and the people in great expectation. But the Lord so appeared on our side, Tillam and his friends appear to have broken in on the preaching and preached up believers' baptism, that instead of there being infant sprinkling in this village, six persons the same evening desired the ordinance of baptism and the next morning were baptized. It gives me no comfort to know that there was infant baptism in the 17th century too. Unfortunately, the leaders of the Newcastle congregation of Baptists, Paul Hobson and Thomas Gower. Paul Hobson, you'll remember, was earlier in Exeter. He's now in the West Country. He's now in the far north. Who had earlier been among those who signed the 1644 Confession, were bitterly opposed to Tillam, partly, it appears, because he was prepared to rely upon his congregation, not prepared to rely on his congregation for full-time maintenance. The dispute, which may have originated in a personality clash, developed into a disagreement over a wider front. Gower and Hobson were committed to a closed communion position, whereas Tillam, who ought to have been, began to consider links with open membership churches during the summer of 1653, and we know that he was sending letters back and forth. Furthermore, while Tillam believed that baptized church members should be received into membership after baptism with the laying on of hands, the older Newcastle Baptist leaders disagreed. One of these causes for conflict with the Newcastle congregation, which, by the way, had been almost certainly founded as a result of the presence there of Baptist soldiers — Paul Hobson was himself now a lieutenant colonel, he'd been a tailor in 1641, self-employed, having a small shop in London. He was now a lieutenant colonel in the Parliamentary Army, deputy governor of the important garrison of Newcastle, which was there, among other things, to keep the Scots out. We have not been successful in more recent centuries in doing that. The conflict there was reported in a letter of the 20th of April 1654 dispatched from Hexham to Henry Jesse's open membership church in London, which complained that a spirit of rigidness doth so far sway among them that they cannot own us because we can own unbaptized churches and ministers for churches of Christ and ministers of Christ, though we also judge in those churches and ministers something as to order wanting, lacking, which God in his own time may reveal unto them. Well, there is the open membership position, I think, put in a nutshell, and their criticism of the closed membership brethren who lived beside them. A spirit of rigidness doth so far sway among them that they cannot own us because we can own unbaptized churches and ministers to be true churches and ministers of Christ. While relations between the Hexham Church and that at Newcastle continued to deteriorate, the influence of the Newcastle Church prevailed in London, with the church in Coleman Street, and Tillam was disowned by the strict communion Baptists home in London, and he later moved on to a Seventh-day Baptist position. And he also wrote Seventh-day Baptist hymns, which were only slightly more horrible than the First-day Baptist hymns of the 17th century. The whole wretched business was not finally cleared up until 1656. Now, this was one of the unsuccessful missions, and it is almost an accident of history and the keeping of one church book which provides us with this story. On the whole, the unsuccessful missions are not recorded because there are no church books, no churches founded, and therefore no church books for recording what happened. In closing this lecture, I want to draw your attention again to the churchmanship of the early Baptist missionaries and to their confidence in the work of outreach. The two seem to go quite clearly together. First, there is the gathering of the newly baptized into organized congregations. Then there is the continuation of outreach by those congregations to form new ones in their turn. And then, as we shall see tomorrow, these are brought into association together. But this group was firm in its evangelism, strong in its mission, was not worried about church order too much in the sense of making sure that everybody was closely supervised, and did follow this going forth after the pattern laid down in the Acts of the Apostles. And it may be of some interest to some of you to know that in as early as 1913, an high church clergyman, an Englishman, a missionary with a society for the propagation of the gospel in China, named Roland Allen, was writing books, one of which was called Missionary Methods, St. Paul's or Ours. And it is only now, 40 years on from his last book and his death, that he is being taken seriously. And the three-self movement in China, which was used by the communist government against the church — self-support, self-government, and self-propagation — is really, in a twisted sort of way, of course, the doctrine of the New Testament church and mission. And it was the doctrine of the New Testament church and mission which our early Baptist churches in England and in New England sought to live by.